day, right? Ready? We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Bensons in the back. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6 Okay. Chris Eaton is here too. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 Chris Eaton is here too, somewhere. Is she here? She's here.
Welcome. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. Today is Monday, March 9th, and we have quite an extensive agenda. We will be meeting this evening to complete the agenda. We will begin to pick up on the agenda at 5:30 in this room. So I appreciate... As you know, I've tried to say this at every meeting, that we have a substantially shorter period of time for our committee to meet each week, and that's caused us to ask all of you to be very concise in your presentations, speaking to the policy issues that are in the bills in front of us, and keeping testimony to those very specific issues, helping the members of our committee to understand the essence of what the bill is doing and why it's resolving problems, whatever the issue is that's in the bill. So we're going to begin with that. The first is a confirmation for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Commissioner Mary Tingerthal. Okay, we have a quorum. Welcome, Commissioner. Let me introduce Mary Tingerthal, who was appointed Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing by Governor Dayton in January 2011. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's mission is to finance affordable housing for low and moderate income Minnesotans while fostering strong communities. Minnesota Housing helps Minnesotans buy and fix up their homes, supports the development and preservation of affordable rental units, and has pioneered a successful model for supportive housing for some of the state's most vulnerable citizens. This agency employs 220 employees to achieve all of those functions. In 2014, Minnesota Housing invested $754 million and assisted more than 59,000 households across the state. State appropriations make up about 9% of the agency's overall budget. Commissioner Tingerthal was confirmed by the Senate in 2013. She brings a public and private sector experience to this position. She also has a deep understanding of the issues that surround affordable housing and development, preservation, and finance. Most recently, Commissioner Tingerthal was the president of Capital Markets Companies for the Housing Partnership Network, where she coordinated the work of the Housing Partnership Fund, which provides acquisition and pre-development financing. Welcome, Commissioner, to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It has been my honor and my pleasure to serve as Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. One thing I'm very proud of is that I actually started my career at Minnesota Housing back in the mid-70s as a young manager, and worked there for 10 years before leaving the agency for 25 years and coming back in 2011. I was very pleased to find an agency that had retained its commitment to affordable housing and to its strong financial management that I had seen back in the 70s and 80s. So it's really been quite a thrill for me to pick up that work after being gone for so many years. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about some of the things that we've been able to bring to the citizens of Minnesota since I rejoined the agency in 2011. Since that time, we have awarded $425 million through our consolidated request for proposals. This is our competitive process every year for awarding scarce dollars to affordable housing developments. That has resulted in more than 15,000 units of housing that are being financed or have been financed across the state. That included funding from two historic bonding bills, both adopted with a very bipartisan approach, the first in 2012 at $35.5 million and the second in 2014 with $100 million. All of those dollars have been awarded to all projects, and many are currently under construction. In that bonding bill, we created the concept of housing infrastructure bonds, really a way to take the state's ability to pay for things over the long term, such as durable goods like housing, and making it work within a system where this housing is most often privately owned and therefore cannot utilize general obligation bonds under the state constitution. Also, since 2011, we have provided $950 million, almost $1 billion, worth of single-family mortgages to more than 7,500 low- and moderate-income households. That is an incredible thing to have done in the wake of the mortgage foreclosure crisis, which saw so many people seem to have to put aside home ownership for the first time for years to come. But we have demonstrated that by offering low-interest, 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, often with down payment assistance, that our young families can, in fact, become homeowners in Minnesota. We have also seen a major improvement in the level of foreclosures in this country, partly by providing foreclosure prevention counseling and home buyer education to almost 55,000 Minnesota households. We've done all this by while at the same time maintaining the financial performance of the organization. As you probably remember, we are rated separately by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, separate from the state on a standalone basis, and our credit ratings remain AA1, AA+. We have also reconfigured during this time the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness and have adopted a new statewide plan to prevent and end homelessness, and are making tremendous efforts in cross-agency collaboration, better targeting of funds, as well as the construction of many new supportive housing units. Also, we have really reached out into Greater Minnesota with what we call our housing and community dialogues. Over the past 2 years, we have hosted dialogues in 8 communities around the state, including places like Worthington, Mankato, Bemidji, and Fergus Falls. We've also participated in housing summits in Duluth, Olmsted County, Roseau, and Thief River Falls. And what's the point of these discussions? It really is to work with communities all over the state to help them understand the resources that this legislature makes available through Minnesota Housing, as well as those resources that we receive through federal resources, and to really help them to articulate what the housing needs are in those communities and how they can best assemble a good competitive application to be able to address those housing needs with state and federal resources. We also have had a great track record over the last several years of trying new things to address issues that you and your communities have raised with us, such things as our housing and job growth initiative focused on workforce housing, rental assistance for highly mobile families that allows families who are participating in programs like Promise Neighborhoods and the Northside Achievement Zone to be able to stay in one place and not have to have their kids bused from another home to their home school. And finally, our targeted mortgage and homeownership capacity programs, which is focused on our various cultural communities to try to reach out to communities that have a lower incidence of being able to buy homes and bringing them to the point where they can become first-time home buyers. We use pilot programs, I think, very effectively to demonstrate to the community and to all of you that there are things that can be done to get at some of our most intractable problems. What we're looking to in the next, in my second term, is to continue the strong foundation that we've established over the last 4 years. I think our track record speaks for itself, and we'd love to be able to continue at that pace. Our current affordable housing plan that covers the time period from October of last year to September of this year calls for spending almost $1 billion of state and federal and local resources for affordable housing in Minnesota. I'd also love to see the implementation of the state's plan to prevent and end homelessness. We have many exciting initiatives underway, such as ending veterans' homelessness by the end of this year through devices such as our Veteran by Veteran Registry, which was just launched last month. And finally, we will begin looking next month in a small symposium at how we can best serve the needs of our low-income senior renters and homeowners. As you know, we have an aging population, and while this state has done well by its seniors in the past, we see some frightening trends in terms of those who may not have very much going into retirement, and once faced with becoming a renter, may have some real trouble affording what rental housing there is available. So with that, I rest my case and take your questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there any questions for the Commissioner? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. Can you just go through again your work on and the proposal for the challenge grant dollars?
Yes.
Commissioner.
Senator Rosen, Madam Chair, one of our largest appropriation categories is known as the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Fund, referred to as the Challenge Fund by most folks. That's a fund that was created in 1999 by this legislature, and it provides dollars that we're able to put into developments throughout the state to provide gap financing to make up the difference between what developers are able to raise in equity and what they can get in debt, and this provides a layer of financing beyond that. And our goal for the coming year, should the appropriations be granted, would be to continue to dedicate those dollars to workforce housing. Not sure if that answers your question, but...
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, are those fairly well dispersed throughout the state and fairly well known among the jurisdictions?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, yes, I believe that they are. We always, one of the reasons that we've instituted the housing and community dialogues around the state is to really work with communities like Roseau, like Thief River Falls, like Worthington, like Rochester, to be able to put together competitive applications. We had some feedback that maybe we weren't as user-friendly as we could be, that perhaps it was a little harder than some communities would like to take on. So we have... taken our show on the road, as it were, and have organized dialogues. I know you hosted us down in Jackson last year to really talk about what is the particular kind of housing that this community needs and how can that community come together with developers to put forward good, strong, and competitive proposals. So every year we take stock of where those dollars go. I think it's also important to note that we don't look just at the Challenge Fund as a resource for developing housing, but we try to do a best fit between the resources that this legislature grants to us and the housing that is best suited for them. So, for example, a big, strong priority of this legislature and of our agency has been to preserve housing that has federal assistance attached to it. And one of the uses that we make of housing infrastructure bonds is for preservation of that housing. It happens that that kind of financing works particularly well with some federal resources that we can leverage. And so one needs to look at the overall picture, because that, by not using our challenge fund for preservation, it allows us to do other projects with the challenge fund. So it's a question of looking at the overall picture.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund, would you be willing to move the committee recommend the appointment of Mary Tingerthal as the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing Finance Agency be confirmed? Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Congratulations. Thank you, Commissioner, for your work. Our next confirmation is for the Minnesota Department of Health, Commissioner Ed Ellinger. Let me introduce you to the committee, as if the committee doesn't know you already. Ed Ellinger was appointed Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health by Governor Dayton in January 2011. Minnesota Department of Health is the state's lead public health agency responsible for operating programs that prevent infections and chronic diseases. It's responsible for operating programs that promote the cleanliness of our water, safe food, quality health care, and health living, healthy living. The department also works to improve the equity of health outcomes in the state by incorporating health equity considerations into every decision or activity which the department is engaged. MDH has a workforce of approximately 1,500 persons and an annual budget of approximately $500 million in the state. That also includes federal and fee-based funds. Commissioner Ellinger was confirmed in 2013. Prior to his appointment as commissioner, Dr. Ellinger served as the director and chief health officer at Boynton Health Services at the University of Minnesota from 1995 to 2011. And he also served as an adjunct professor in the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He has an MD from the University of Wisconsin, an MSPH from the University of North Carolina, and is board certified in both internal medicine and in pediatrics. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I'll tell you a little bit about myself and just a little bit about our agency and be open to some questions. When I started into my medical career, now many decades ago, I was planning on being a doc in a rural community. And so all my training was really about being a rural physician doing primary care. And I started doing that, but I learned very quickly within just a couple of months that I could be seeing lots of patients every single day in that clinic and really making an impact on the lives of those individuals, but that the health of the community wouldn't really be improved dramatically, that there were too many other factors that were actually influencing the health of my patients, factors like tobacco use or obesity or a unclean environment or foodborne illnesses that were affecting them, injuries in the workplace. And it really focused to me that there needed to be more than just clinical care. So I've been fortunate in my career to be able to actually work in places where I could integrate medical care and public health, and really found that the power of improving health in our communities is really both the medical system and the public health system. And so when I got the opportunity in 2011 to be Commissioner of Health, I jumped at it immediately, because it is truly an honor to be part of an agency that really plays a pivotal role in the health of our community. We know that a lot of work occurs at the state level in public, at the local level in public health, and we know that the federal government has a lot of role to play in public health. But it's really through the state health department that you bring all of those factors together that really serves as the linchpin for coordinating the public health activities and linking the public health activities with the medical care activities that are so important in improving health and maintaining health. And certainly in coming to the state health department, I recognize that Minnesota has one of the best health departments in the country. As I work with my peers throughout the country, they always say, you are very fortunate to be able to be at the Minneapolis or the Minnesota Department of Health because of its stature. And it's that way because of the employees that work there. They're mission-driven. They have expertise in lots of areas. And they really are dedicated to improving the health of all Minnesotans. But I also recognize that the department does not deal with public health alone. We have multiple partners. Certainly, local public health is a major partner of ours. A lot of community health organizations, hospital associations, medical associations, nursing associations, all working collaboratively. But I also recognize that health is not just the responsibility of those health agencies. It's really my working with county commissioners and with the legislature and my fellow commissioners throughout in Dayton's administration recognizing that their role in developing policies and programs and systems is really important in creating health. And it's been a real pleasure to work with them collaboratively to really improve the health of Minnesotans over the last 4 years. Certainly, we've done a lot of things, and I just want to highlight a few very briefly. Certainly, some of the classic things that health departments do, dealing with infectious diseases, and the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa over the last several months has really highlighted the importance of really being prepared to deal with infectious diseases. The yearly onslaught of influenza, where the state health department really coordinates and educates and provides leadership in addressing influenza. The recent case of measles that we've had recognizes the fact that working to collaboratively keep immunization levels high, make sure vaccine is safe and distributed, is one of those things that the health department does and does very well in collaboration with all of our partners. Similarly, foodborne outbreaks. Minnesota probably has the best response to any foodborne outbreak program in the country. We are a leader in that area. The Centers for Disease Control actually looks to us and our lab in leadership and providing identification of what problems are occurring with foodborne outbreaks. And so we've identified things early on in outbreaks before any the CDC has or other state health departments. That continues to be a real feather in the cap of Minnesota. So those are some of the things that we've dealt with that have traditionally been there, but new things are constantly coming up. And certainly in the last year, we've implemented a cannabis program for medical cannabis, working with the legislature to design a program that I think is going to really move the needle forward in terms of identifying the risks and the benefits of medical cannabis for individuals who really need that treatment. I believe that we will have one of the best run and best health cannabis medical cannabis programs in the country. Similarly, with our report of advancing health equity, we've identified the fact that we have lots of disparities in this state. It's a state that overall is very healthy, but with increasing diversity, recognizing that if we don't deal with the disparities, our stature as a healthy state will decline. And so by calling forward the partners throughout the state to address health equity, they're really talking about what creates health and what policies and systems changes need to be made to really advance health equity has been really a remarkable thing to see and lead and be part of. Similarly, as we recognize that infectious diseases were the leading causes of death in the first part of the 20th century, chronic diseases were the leading causes of death in the second part of the 20th century, and continuing on into the 21st century. And through the approach that we've taken statewide with our local public health partners to advance a policy system, environment change through the SHIP program, has really been a model for the country. This is a model that the new sort of identifying ways of public health to address chronic diseases. That is our vaccination for chronic diseases, and we're seeing results of that with some of the changes in obesity, with changes in some of the breastfeeding rates, things that really are going to be making a difference in our community. So those are just some of the things that we've identified with the traditional public health, with the new public health, and I'm really honored and pleased that Governor Dayton has appointed me to this position. I'm honored to be the leader of the MDH, and really am pleased to be working with you in partnership to create a healthy Minnesota. Really, at my stage in life where I'm, I've worked for a long time, my kids are doing well, but I'm doing this for my grandkids and my great-grandkids. How are we going to invest in Minnesota? When I drove through Minnesota in 1973 on my way to Montana to work in a rural clinic, I picked up that Life magazine or Time magazine with Governor Anderson on there saying the good life in Minnesota. And as I review what happened at that time, it was the investments that were made in the public good, investments that were made in public health, investments that were made in education, investments that were made in the environment and the business community that are really paying the benefits now. So my work as state health commissioner is say, how can we invest in health for now and in the future so my grandchildren and great-grandchildren will look back and say, Minnesota is a great place to live. So with that, I'm open to any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You mentioned we have had hearings here on the health disparities. Could you speak a little more as to what outcomes you're discovering and what specifically you're doing to try to close the disparities gaps?
One of the things, Madam Chair and committee members, one of the things that I've really learned over the years is that we in Minnesota have, I believe, and arguably, the best medical care system in the country, and it's rated number one. But I've also discovered that we cannot treat our way into equity. With all of the great medical care we have, there are other factors that are overpowering our medical care system, the policy system, the economic wages, employment, education, housing, transportation, environment, all of those factors are really playing a role in creating the disparities that we have in our state. And so the approach that we've been taking is really a health and all policies approach, where eliminating disparities is not just the responsibility of the health department. It really is the responsibility of everyone in our society, the business community, certainly policymakers. You have a huge role in playing in setting up the policies. My fellow commissioners who in their agencies recognize that if they do housing appropriately, as Commissioner Tingerthal is doing, that's going to address disparities. If we close the achievement gap in education, that's going to address disparities. So what we are providing is information to all of those agencies, to all of those sectors about how what they do can really impact health. For example, last year we put out a report on income and health that helped inform the debate around minimum wage. The fact that increasing somebody from the lowest quintile of income to the second lowest quintile of income actually increases their life expectancy by about 3.5 years. And people of color and American Indians are disproportionately represented in that. We will be putting out a report soon at the end of this week related to sick leave and paid parental leave and its impact on health, recognizing that the people who are disadvantaged by lack of paid sick leave and lack of paid parental leave are generally people of color and low-income populations. And so those are the things that we're really working on to say collectively we need to work together to really reduce those disparities. Certainly, we continue to work with the medical care system to make sure that the care is culturally appropriate, that people have access to care, but it's really a policy system and environment change that is going to have to be put into place to address those disparities.
Are there other questions? Yes, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, you mentioned a study that's coming out the end of the week. Was that a legislatively authorized study?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, yes, we were asked by several legislators to put together this report.
But, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Benson.
Regularly, when we ask the department to do studies, we're told that we need to fund 1 to 2 FTEs to do a study. And now, Madam Chair, it appears the commissioner has the authority to do studies without FTEs. And I think as we go forward with our budget, that will be helpful information to know. I do have some questions, Madam Chair, about quite serious things. Your clinical data repository is real-time data to give a unified view of a single patient. I'd like the commissioner to talk about how we protect the privacy of individuals when the Department of Health is working very hard to have a unified view of a single patient.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, data are very important, as you're well aware, for all of the work that gets done in this state for health and for public health. I believe that one of the things that we're working on now is to make sure that the providers, our clinicians, our hospitals, our long-term care facilities have access to the data that they need to really provide high-quality, coordinated care. And so the work that is being done with the data repository and the health information exchanges is really about making sure that the providers of clinical services get the right data so that they can provide safe, effective data. Certainly, as we work, we also believe that data privacy and data security are of primary importance. So we use all of the means that we have available to us to secure the data, to make sure that no one has access to the data, that without the need to have that and the appropriate controls in that. That goes for all of the data sources that we have.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair and Dr. Ellinger, it's interesting that you use the word need with regard to access and not permission. I'm very concerned that you're building a database where you're happy to share with medical providers, medical entities, without regard for the patient's consent for use of that data. And specifically because you use the word need. I understand you can take measures to prevent hacking and so forth, but if the patient doesn't have to consent at every level of data sharing, then you're violating that person's right because the data belongs to the person, especially if you're focused on a single patient view, because that means it's identifiable data. And I'd like you to address that, please.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, when I use the term need when I'm talking about clinical care as the clinicians to really provide high quality, safe care, effective care, they need per certain individual information about the patients that they're seeing, and so we want to make sure that they get that kind of information. And when people go to clinics, they sign release the HIPAA form for release of information that can be used in caring for them. Those are the kinds of things that we are concerned about. Those are the things that we really work on. When we are dealing with public health data, these are, within rare exceptions, we use de-identified data for all of our analyses. The exceptions are if we are, for example, following up on a sexually transmitted infection or a TB case where we need personal information in order to be able to do the work that we do. Most other data are aggregate data when they're used for any other studies.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Ellinger, the HIPAA forms are not mandatory. So that doesn't mean just because someone has seen a patient that the patient has given their consent for their data to be shared. And so I think we need to look more deeply into what protocols the department is taking to ensure that there is a form on file giving permission for that care provider to have access to the data at the department and that the individual is aware that data is being collected on them and shared whenever they sign that form of release. I think we have some significant concerns around data at the Department of Health. We watch it very carefully in public safety, and it's time for us to start watching it in public health, particularly as Commissioner Ellinger talks about the impact of economics on health disparity, the impact of geography on health disparity, the impact of race and ethnicity, transportation, access to education. It seems that there would be no limit as to what this department could collect on an individual. And I think we need to be very cautious about how far this data collection goes.
Are there any further questions? Then my final question would be, how are the horseshoe competitions going?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have pitched horseshoes with several of you, and I would like to pitch horseshoes with all of you. In the last 4 years, I've really gone around the state and in communities pitching horseshoes because it's a great way to have conversations with leaders. I've discovered that county commissioners are my best friends in public health because they know what's going on at the local level, the community level, and they have a lot of influence on health. So it's been a great way to do that. It's been fun to do that. And if you'd like to invite me to your community to pitch horseshoes, I'd be glad to do that when the weather is appropriate.
That's great. Senator Hayden.
Well, Madam Chair, I couldn't resist. I haven't been able to pitch horseshoes with you, Dr. Ellinger, but I'm not quite sure where in my district we would pitch horseshoes at. I was just trying to think about that. We do have a small skee ball this, our machine in one of the restaurants. But I think I would love to. I would like to take this time, Madam Chair, to say that I have found that working with the Department of Health under Dr. Ellinger's leadership, I really think we have progressed over the years that I've been here, and I know that I've been one to really kind of push, especially on this issue of health equity. And I think that the transformation that they're under in dealing with the health equity issue in the Office of Health Equity, I really think is starting to take hold. I know that nationally people are talking about the health equity report, but also locally people are very tuned in, and there's a lot of work yet to be done, but there are great initiatives that are happening. I find that especially in communities of color and immigrant communities, that they are feeling like there are access points, that they are actually getting practical things done to try to kind of turn the tide of these health disparities. So I do want to thank Dr. Ellinger for that work. I know it's been tough, and you've had to bring in a lot of different, you've had to take a broader view of how to look at health equity as you've articulated today. But I do, on the ground, when you talk to people, I do feel like there is change happening. People are feeling like that they have that access, and they are now starting to kind of, it's starting to take hold. And I hope that over the next 4 years, if you stay that long, that we have this conversation, that our numbers really are starting to change. So are the needles starting to move? So thanks again for your help and your service to the state, Dr. Ellinger.
Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, I would like to move that this committee recommend that the appointment of Ed Ellinger as commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health be confirmed.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Nay.
Congratulations. Thank you,
thank
Commissioner.
You very much.
All right, we move now to Senate File 746. Senator Carlson, is he with us? Okay.
Thanks, Amy.
Welcome to our committee, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have a Senate file 746 for you to hear. 746 is a rather simple bill that makes a major change in the access that children can get for their parents' medical records. I want to tell you a personal story, but first I'll just give you a little bit of a tease on this, that today our families are undergoing a lot of modifications. There are the facts of marriages and divorces, second marriages, and sometimes the spouse is not the same spouse that presently exists when a family elder dies. And what happens is that the children cannot get the medical record of that parent that passed away. And I want to give you a little personal story about it first. On August 5th of 2014, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm sure many of you can identify with the shock this kind of news gives you throughout your whole family. As you may know, the patient and the family goes through many stages of why and why me with this news. My wife had a slightly different and practical reaction. Her reaction was, I knew it was coming. She carries a photo with her of her family at one of her sister's weddings. And it has three of her sisters, her father, her mother, her brother, brother-in-law, and even a dog in it. And the dog died of cancer. The mother, the father, the brother, the sisters, all of them died of cancer. So that's why she looks at it to say, I knew it was coming. As part of her process, we were referred to a genetic counselor to more fully understand and research the answer to the questions, why me? And what does this mean to our children? Because we have both a son and a daughter. The shortened story is that my wife's DNA did not show damage to the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene that gives that's known to be given a connection to and the propensity for developing breast cancer. She did show an anomaly in the CHEK4 gene. This gene is suspicious, and it's not known to necessarily give you the propensity for cancer, but it's still being monitored, and she is on a monitored list now. someday that information may come to pass that check 4 does show some propensity. Personally, I can't conceive of the fact that if I would pass away, my wife would pass away, that our children would not have direct access to our medical records. My wife's chain of the legacy of ancestors had a lot of cancer. There is a lot of research going on, and I think this is very valuable to any child to know about when they perhaps are faced with a congenital disease. What I have here is I have a couple of testifiers who are going to be able to tell you how this affected their lives. And first I'm going to introduce Holly Newman to give you her perception of what has happened to her.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Holly Newman. A few days after my father passed away, I came across a letter where my father was warning us that his heart disease was genetic. When I had first gotten this letter years ago, I wasn't as concerned with getting heart disease, but since my father just died of a staph infection in his heart, I now understood the need to get tested. At my next doctor appointment, I asked my doctor to do the test my father had requested. The doctor said she hadn't heard of that test. She tried to look it up, but couldn't find it. She needed to know more medical details about my father's medical condition in order to know which test to order. So I tried to get my father's medical records, only to find out that current Minnesota law doesn't allow us for this. In 2011, my daughter Camille was involved in a serious accident which involved extensive hospitalization. She developed a serious infection that wasn't healing. Her doctors requested a more extensive family medical history regarding the immune system. My father had died of an unusual infection in the heart 4 years earlier at the same hospital a few rooms away, so I again needed his records. I tried to get them again, but was told that even her doctors couldn't look at them. The lady in the records department wanted to help me, but all she could do is tell me that many other people had the problem as well. Every time we go to the doctor, dentist, chiropractor, or even therapist, they ask us to fill out a health history which includes a family medical history. With the advances in the medical field of genetics, this information has proven to be critical. I've spoken to genetic counselors and doctors that have told me this change in law would help people with diseases like cancer, heart disease, autism, lupus, asthma, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and hundreds of other medical conditions. Family medical history is an extremely useful tool in understanding health risks and preventing diseases and diagnosing medical conditions. Thank you for your taking the time to hear me speak.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. And this is Ms. Bondas.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
I'm Joan Bondas. I am the mother of Holly and three other children. Holly's the youngest of my four children. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. Holly's father and I have eight grandchildren and two great-grandchildren. Five of them are already having mental, physical, genetic problems that we need answers for. It's very frustrating when we're denied access to these records. Let's see. Made lots of different notes here.
Take your time.
Passing this bill would also save money in medical costs for the surviving children, grandchildren, and also for the state due to the fact that people would have access to genetic health records of their family line. Excuse me. Doctors wouldn't be wasting a lot of time searching for causes of illnesses if they knew what was behind the genetic records and if they already had the reasons for it. All of my now adult children have lived with unusual medical problems. if they had, would be able to have the access to their father's medical records, they would better be able to work with the doctors at times of need, like my granddaughter in the accident that she was in. Instead of all the time that doctors are looking for answers, they'd be able to have them if they had the genetic records.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any others who wish to speak to this legislation at this time? Seeing none, are there any questions from the members of the committee for our testifiers or for Senator Carlson? Seeing none, Senator Carlson, I look for a motion. Okay, Senator Wicklund moves 746 Health Records Act be passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. It passes. Thank you very much, Senator Clausen. Carlson. Senator Clausen, I think, is next, isn't he? Oh, Eakin. Senator Eakin is next. What was I saying?
Did you really?
Okay, Senator Eakin. Is he here? Oh, there you are. Welcome, Senator Eakin, to the committee. You're presenting Senate File 902.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The State Quality Council is charged with improving the state's system for ensuring services for persons with disabilities are of the highest possible quality. This will be done by implementing a statewide quality improvement system. The Council is committed to a quality system that is person-centered, data and quality driven, outcome based, and effective in its use of public funds. The State Quality Council received startup funding in 2011, but was not funded in 2013. Despite this, the council was still supported by DHS over the past 2 years. The State Quality Council, I believe, will be a driving force in Minnesota's compliance with the Olmstead Plan. By assuring that Minnesotans with disabilities have a voice through participation on the state and regional quality councils, by surveying persons with disabilities, by having persons with disabilities actively participate in setting statewide quality improvement goals, we will enhance everyone's ability to live and work in the most integrated setting. Senate File 902 proposes funding for the State Quality Council, statewide surveys of persons with disabilities, and three regional quality councils, which will be made of stakeholders, including the counties, providers, persons with disabilities, and their families. And I have with me here today Lance Hegland, the co-chair of the State Quality Council, and Dan Zimmer, the director of the Region 10 Quality Commission.
Thank you. Is this your first hearing, Senator?
This is my first hearing, yes.
So there is an amendment? Do I understand there's
yes,
an amendment?
There is
an amendment. We can take that up right now. Senator Wicklund offers the A1 amendment, which simply looks like a simple number change.
Yes.
And it should be in your packets, everybody. Is there anyone who would like to ask anything about the amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. Passes. And please introduce your testifiers.
Sure. First, we'll begin with Mr. Lance Hegland, who is the co-chair of the State Quality Council.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hegland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lance Hegland. I'm a co-chair for the Minnesota State Quality Council. I'm also the recipient of disability services. I strongly support Senate File 902. Currently, when my personal care agency enrolls as a provider, Minnesota checks to make sure it meets minimum standards. Do they have adequate policies and procedures? Do they have sufficient administrative support? This check merely ensures the provider has some of the tools and blueprints necessary for quality services at that particular moment. But how do we know these resources are actually producing quality over a period of time? We don't. Our current quality assurance system doesn't really maximize public value. For example, How would Minnesota know that I've experienced more dehydration, more digestive challenges, and skin breakdown over the past year? My voice is currently unheard. How would Minnesota know it's been more difficult for me to work over the past year to contribute to our communities? Again, my voice is unheard. How would Minnesota know that these symptoms have increased my clinical and pharmaceutical use? Again, my voice is unheard. And how would Minnesota know if other individuals and families are experiencing similar symptoms? Their voices are unheard as well. How would Minnesota know if quality is decreasing, even though public spending is remaining constant? It wouldn't. As a result, we wouldn't know when or what to investigate. We're prevented from discovering a strong correlation that actually exists between worker turnover, growing shortage of workers. Maybe we'd find out in a year or two through our infrequent consumer surveys that are sent out to families. But in the meantime, we've wasted opportunities to improve quality. We've wasted opportunity to increase public value. Minnesota needs to hear the voices of individuals and families more frequently. We need to be more responsive to the feedback we're receiving. We need to be more proactively seize opportunities to improve quality and public value. Bottom line, Senate File 902 is an investment in quality assurance to help us monitor performance trends. It provides the state ears to hear our voices. It more quickly triggers response when we're not getting intended results. It ensures public value. Senate File 902 is an investment to seize these opportunities to improve and sustain quality disability support services. Senate File 902 is an investment in public stewardship. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hegelin. And Mr. Zimmer?
Dan Zimmer is the director of the Region 10 Quality Commission, which has, I think, laid out some good blueprints to follow for future implementation of such plans across the state.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dan Zimmer. I'm the director for Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance. For over 15 years now, we have used a regional community approach to quality, very focused on quality improvement, very focused on person-centered planning for individuals with disabilities. One of the things I was asked to talk about was what would be a difference if our state used regional councils and had the state quality council operating at full capacity. And I think one of the biggest differences is that we'd be more proactive in our quality approaches instead of reactive. And I think everybody here can say that there have been times when, as a state, we've been reactive to problems, seeing them late and not being able to improve on them in time to help people with disabilities as well as we should have. Our approach, when people hear about Region 10 Quality Assurance, they think of the voice review. They think of the tool that we use for quality. And it's really structured on quality improvement. It's not as much of a look in the past. It's about the look in the now. It's about a look in the outcomes for people with disabilities and what's happening for them and really strengthening those teams to move forward and get better and work together to make quality improvement a reality. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we're going to have with the Olmsted Plan is how do we move forward? I think everybody here embraces the ideals of helping people with disabilities be inclusive in their community and a full member of their community. We need to have the tools to help every community achieve that. And by bringing everything that a regional council can do closer to that, to those providers, to those people with disabilities, and having the people with disabilities being part of those regional councils will help us immensely achieve better success with our Olmsted Plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you like to describe anything more about the bill before in order to allow the committee to understand what you're trying to achieve? And then we'll open it up for questions from council, from our senators.
Madam Chair and members, in 2013, the State Quality Council legislative report, the council made recommendations, and this legislation is designed to implement those recommendations. It includes statewide surveys of people with disabilities that will help identify the opportunities for improvement. It also includes a review of current data that's collected to identify significant trends and need that need action. Also, funding for three regional quality councils. And each council will lead local efforts to improve quality and implement new licensing systems that ensure the voices of the people with disabilities are being heard. One is designed to be in the rural area, one in the cities, and then there's the Region 10 Council, which already exists. And maybe some changes there as well. This is still a work in progress, obviously, and what we're looking at is kind of a pilot project that's expanding now. We're trying to expand it to reach more areas of the state and hope that eventually we'll reach everyone in the state. But this is the beginning of it. As I said, Region 10 has already been laying out a blueprint that I think will lead to success in the other two regional councils that are going to be established with this bill. Then eventually three others being established in 2016, but eventually expanding out to cover the whole state. And also it asks for continued funding for the State Quality Council, which, as I said, was not funded after it was initially put in place in 2011. And so we're asking for funding for that as well to organize this and to get these regional councils established and moving in the right direction. And again, I guess the ultimate goal here is to ensure that those receiving the services are going to have a voice in the process, to make sure that we're putting in place quality programs across the state. And the licensing process, I think it'll inform the licensing process to make sure that the licensing process does meet up with the larger goals of providing better quality services for these individuals. Again, the above recommendations were not funded in 2013 and 2014. But the Department of Human Services has obviously seen this as an important program, an important proposal, because they have continued to work with this even without the funding as it's moved forward.
Senator Rosen and then Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Eakin, I was wondering about the amendment. And I support this. I think this is a great initiative. But on the amendment, you're deleting 3 in the Section 3. Line 17 on page 5. Is there something that should be done on section 2, subdivision 4, on line page 3.22? Establish 3 additional regional quality councils. Is your goal to get away from a specific number of quality councils?
Yeah, well, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I believe that still would remain. The last section was talking about the regional councils generally, so there's going to be more than 3 in the end. But we're funding initially here 3 regional councils. But again, I think that the reason that the word 3 was removed in the end is because it's not going to be a total of 3. I'm not sure what the exact number is going to be. I think that's still to be determined. I had heard as many as 11, I guess, and I don't know if that's true or not.
Mr. Zimmer.
Mr. Zimmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I didn't hear 11. Really, the recommendations from the State Quality Council come back to 2007, and that there was a quality assurance panel from DHS, and they came forward with the recommendations to form that State Quality Council. And at that time, they were talking about 6 regions in the state. Having now working with the State Quality Council that's in existence, they're trying to determine what that number might be. There is some talk of it still being 6, but it could be 7 or 8. It really seems like there's a feeling of at least 2 in the metro area and some more outstate. So I don't know where 11 came from.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Eakin, this is a great bill. I'm so glad that you've brought it forward and that you've brought Dan Zimmer with you as well. quality, Region 10 quality assurance is part of my district. That includes my district. And I will just tell you, in the committee, it is highly effective. It is data-driven. It's outcome-driven. The results are consumer-driven, which they should be. And the voice review is essential. And the results have just really been the very effective use of state dollars in getting the right care for the right person in the right way. And I would just say it's incredible. It's one of the most successful initiatives that I've seen in my district. It's been ongoing now since I can remember, really, since at least 2002 or 3, I think, was the first time I recalled a Quality 10 region. And it's wonderful. And so it would be, as Senator Eakin said, you know, the blueprint is there. There's a successful blueprint from which to start, not to say that there might not be modifications, because certainly it is about continual improvement. But I will say there's a great record here, and it'd be great to see it continue.
I want to give Senator Hoffman a chance to ask his questions, but with that kind of endorsement, I'll have you make the motion when the time comes,
okay,
if you'd like.
Love to.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What a great endorsement. I'm still having a hard time trying to wrap my arms around the collaboration that could exist or might exist. And I guess I'm wondering out loud, there seems to be other initiatives out in the state that are doing these types of councils, and whether it be and outcome driven, and I hear one of your testifiers mention Olmstead, and we're all being driven by this Olmstead decision of 1999. You know, some 16 years later, we're now finally, you know, jumping into that. But I'm wondering why I don't see names like the Governor's DD Council in there, and I don't see, you know, other collaborative entities that, you know, have a stake in assuring outcomes for people with disabilities. And if it's just a licensing issue, I guess then rock on, you know. But I guess I'm trying to wonder, where are the other folks that are also trying to drive initiatives out there statewide? Like Rick Cardenas has a couple of projects. They do some regional working with advocates, and, you know, are we having those conversations with those people? Is the ARC Minnesota involved in these conversations? Is CC? I just, you know, is this just one more council that we're going to operate in a silo, or are we going to do things collaboratively so we get the good intended outcomes that we want?
Senator Eakin?
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, I think you bring up an excellent point. We don't want to be creating any silos here. We do want to be working together to make sure that we maximize, a positive outcome here. And I do have with me today Steve Larson from the ARC as well, that could probably testify to what work has been done, you know, with other entities to ensure that we don't create silos here, like you say. So,
I can,
Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have a very large.
This is Mr. Heglin. I'm going to say your name for the record.
Oh, sure. My name is Lance Heglin. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have the council is actually made up of stakeholders from across the community and across the state. And so we have folks from ARC on the council. We have folks from various counties on the council. And various advocacy groups that we've invited to come in. We have the Office of the Ombudsman. And so anyone who wants to be participate in the council, any of those groups, our hope is to create kind of a one-stop shop for quality disability services. And our hope is that those regional councils then would be able to have representatives locally who are also doing that quality work, so that they can feed that information up. So I think our council is hoping to bring all those groups together to make sure that we're not duplicating those quality efforts, and that we're using all the information we can to increase the value that we're able to provide. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I will talk with Senator Eakin. I just am having a hard time wrapping my arms around just what we're trying to accomplish here. And I know it was created in 2011 as a negotiation or whatever, and I see there's an emphasis on Region 10, which is Rochester area. And so I just wanted to make sure that it's the ships are going in the same direction regarding what we're trying to achieve and not really, again, looking at isolated, a siloed approach. So I'll just, in the interest of time, I'm fine with moving this on, and then we'll connect afterwards. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm also interested in further conversation as this moves forward. One of the areas of concern I have is the way we've changed as a result of consumer-driven decision-making and choice, which I really support. But I've read articles and I've heard, you know, stories here and there about concerns about oversight and supervision for personal care attendant services. And that's a high concern of mine that we are losing more and more of our capacity to know. This is can be a very vulnerable population who can be in a situation where they can be exploited or harmed, and because they're so dependent on those PCAs and others to provide services, they may feel afraid, just as any victim is sometimes, to report. So I'm hoping that there is something very specific through these quality initiatives that will help us address that problem as we move. It's just one of the potential problems that occur as we try to achieve other objectives about independence and choice. So I don't need a response to that, but I wanted you to know, Senator, that is a quality issue that I'm very concerned about. Did you have a motion, Senator Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair. And before I make that motion, let me just say that the State Quality Council Region 10 is very person-centered. That's what's so unique about what I have witnessed there. It's very person-centered, consumer-driven, by the consumer. That would be the person using services. And it's about maximizing that choice, that consumer choice. So I'm very glad to move Senate File 902 as amended to
state and local
government.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Clausen is in the room. Senate File 1246. Welcome, Senator Clausen. Please begin. We have a number of handouts in your packets that include some maps that give information about professional shortage areas in the state. And I think that they will be helpful as you're listening to Senator's testimony. Is this an amendment for this bill?
Yes. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee. And thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1246, a healthcare workforce initiative. And, Madam Chair, I would at this time like to offer the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is being distributed at this time. Do you have it? Do you all have it? And you're also receiving a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, the A1 amendment basically has three provisions. It corrects errors in the body of the bill. Secondly, it expands and defines membership of the Minnesota Healthcare Workforce Council. And lastly, it identifies the appropriation related to the bill.
No, you did, and you lost.
Senator Clausen, I've had a group come to me talk about membership. Are you continuing to consider further amendments to the membership of this group?
Yes, Madam Chair. On the A1 amendment, there have been some changes. If you look at line 1.3 through 1.7, and I know that some additional groups have also shared with me their desire to be on the council, and we'll take that into consideration.
Is there an opportunity for you to amend this further as this moves forward?
Madam Chair, I haven't had a chance to really directly talk to them. I've received secondary information via email and so on. I would like an opportunity to meet with these folks before we'd move an amendment.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to continue. If we aren't going to take care of that in the committee, I'd like to continue to have that information come my way before we get the bills passed on the floor.
Yes, Madam Chair, I know that we'll have another stop in another committee that we could do that.
Okay, the A1 amendment has been, is this your first stop? No.
Yes,
it is your first stop. Okay, so this is an authorized amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thinking something, Senator Rosen?
Not on the committee. Yeah, he's not on the committee. I can.
Oh, I thought Senator Rosen did move that.
Yeah.
Should we do it again?
See?
I think we better just say Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. This is not looking good for me. This is the first of my committee hearings this week, and I'm already a little...
You're doing great.
a little whacked out. Okay, thank you. Senator Claussen, please proceed.
Thank you. Senate File 1246 is the result of two legislative actions. The first, in 2014, the legislature authorized a two-year health care commission to identify current and anticipated health care workforce shortages and evaluate the effectiveness of incentives to retain a highly skilled workforce. Representative Huntley, who has since retired, myself, co-chaired the commission. The commission met through the summer and fall of 2014 to develop preliminary recommendations for the 2015 legislature. Our second action by the legislature in 2013, the legislature initiated a study to assess mental health workforce needs. Over 30 mental health professionals met for 18 months, conducted 20 community forums and outreach meetings throughout the state, surveyed over 500 residents, and held a mental health summit attended by over 150 professionals. Senate File 1246 reflects the work of these two legislative initiatives and is the second of two bills resulting from these actions, the first being Senate File 3, a health care loan forgiveness proposal. Senate File 3 addresses the end of the job pipeline, placing people in rural and underserved communities by providing loan forgiveness initiatives. And Senate File 1246 is intended to fill the health care workforce pipeline through four major provisions. And I'll go through those four major provisions, Madam Chair, that are part of the bill. Section 1 establishes a Minnesota Health Care Workforce Council. It identifies the purpose and responsibilities of the council, defines council membership, and requires the council to prepare a comprehensive workforce plan every 5 years. Provisions to be included in the workforce plan are also identified in Section 1. Section 2 establishes a grant program to expand clinical training facilities and sites for physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, and mental health professionals. The Workforce Commission and the Mental Health Workforce Group both learned of the challenges in providing the training needed to give advanced practice nursing, physician assistant, and mental health students the hands-on skills needed to begin practice. These grants will begin to address that need by providing support to 10 to 15 programs each year. Section 3 expands primary care physician residencies grants, or slots. There will be six that will be dedicated to family medicine. That also includes general internal medicine and general pediatrics. Four are dedicated to psychiatry, two in geriatrics, and general surgery, two. Over 3 years, these grants would fund 42 new primary care residency slots. Section 4 provides for a grant incentive program for preceptors who mentor a medical resident or medical student, advanced practice registered nurse, physician assistant, or mental health professional student. The Workforce Commission learned that many individual preceptors are not compensated for teaching and are not and are finding it more and more challenging to make room in their schedules to serve as preceptors. This action would provide up to $1,500 a year to preceptors who are not otherwise compensated for teaching and mentoring. And Section 5 is the appropriation request. Providing testimony, we have several people. I'd like to begin with Mark Schoenbaum, Director of Rural Health and Primary Care, Minnesota Department of Health, and also Mr. Michael Belzer, Chief Medical Officer and Medical Director at the Hennepin County Medical Center.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. Senator Claussen gave my title at the Health Department. It's also my honor to have served as a staff to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. And I know on Senator Claussen's Senate File 3, the committee heard some of the background on these issues, so maybe just a brief touch on one of the basic questions. So in reviewing the state's healthcare workforce situation and thinking about whether intervention was needed, an obvious question is, do we have enough healthcare workers in the right places, in the right occupations? And the Workforce Commission did ask that question. The three colored maps you have before you are one answer to that question. And they identify where there are shortages in the three occupations largely addressed in the bill: primary care, mental health, and dental shortages. There's no perfect way, and I think we had this conversation before, there's no perfect indicator of adequacy and shortage, and there was good discussion on the Workforce Commission about some of the imperfections in this particular indicator, and that's on the to-do list for future refinement. But nonetheless, you know, these are commonly used. They're a good baseline, and I think you only have to take a glance at them to not be surprised that the Workforce Commission did conclude that in these core health professions, there are significant shortages in many areas of the state.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Belzer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Michael Belzer. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Hennepin County Medical Center. And additionally, I'm the Vice Chair of the legislature-mandated and funded MERC Medical Education Research Cost Committee. And on behalf of the Metro Minnesota Council for Graduate Medical Education, which is a council that represents 16 hospitals and 1,400 residents and fellows, we support the recommendations in this bill and feel that it will further advance workforce training. Of note, approximately 70% of our graduate trainees, our residents, do stay on to practice in Minnesota. Obviously, we're at a critical time for healthcare as we face an increasing healthcare workforce pressures with an aging population and an aging provider physician workforce. And although we support this bill in its entirety, let me address two components of the bill that Senator Claussen outlined. First is the primary care residency expansion. Funding for residency positions and slots for training sites was actually financially capped 20 years ago by the federal government in 1996. Obviously, much has transpired in the past 20 years to alter that landscape and have led to a widely agreed upon Minnesota physician and provider shortage. Minnesota clearly needs more primary care physicians. Rather than starting new residency programs, which would take many years to implement, we feel the best way to increase the number of healthcare professionals in primary care would be to utilize our existing residency programs and our existing training sites. Residency programs are multi-year programs, typically lasting 3 to 5 years, and that's why we're solidly in favor of long-term funding for these programs. Otherwise, programs wouldn't commit to taking on residents for that period of time unless the funding was long-term. Second, the healthcare professions provider preceptor incentive. Well, I'm sure you're aware that in addition to being a public good, you realize that healthcare is a business. Providers are compensated based on their work production,
and teaching students adversely impacts on a clinician's productivity. And if you were a busy physician or advanced practice provider and faced the choice of maintaining your present salary or taking a salary cut to train students who are advanced practice providers, well, you can see what the dilemma is. A key limiting factor for healthcare professionals is exactly that. It's their willingness or unwillingness to train the next generation of providers because they're productivity-based compensation. At Hennepin this last Friday, as a matter of fact, our advanced practice provider mentor and I were talking about a circumstance of a student who's going to have to delay her graduation for a year, a whole year. She's an advanced practice nurse student because a rotation mentor can't be found for her. And this is not an unusual situation. It's not isolated. We hear about this from our other hospitals, and we face this dilemma every single week with the expansion of physician assistant programs and advanced practice nurse programs. There just are not enough tutors to teach the students. And then finally, a question you might ask is, will these incentives actually work? In my opinion and that of my colleagues, definitely yes. For the past 25 years, as a program oversight residency director at Hennepin County Medical Center, we get asked every year by every program to increase the number of residents in those programs. And because we're capped at our 96 slots for financing, we just have to say no every year because of expense. And only once did we expand a program. That was a primary care program, our family medicine program, and we expanded it because of a CMS grant that allowed us to fund the new residents. When the grant was expired, we had to contract the program. So in other words, if subsidized, there's no doubt in my mind that we will expand residency programs. And as we asked advanced practice providers every single week, they tell us if we want them to precept, is there something we can do about their productivity compensation? And again, I think this grant program would go a long way increasing preceptors. So let me say thank you for allowing me to testify in support of Senate File 1246, and let me express my appreciation to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission and Senator Clausen for all their hard background work for leading to the introduction of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And let me add my thanks to Senator Clausen and to all that have worked over a long period of time, convening stakeholders, groups, listening, understanding, developing an understanding of this kind of workforce shortage in the areas that we need to focus on. This has been a huge task to create the recommendations and then to bring them forward in the form of legislation. So we're grateful. The Senate is grateful to you for that, Senator. And I can tell you from my own experience as well, I can confirm what's being described by Dr. Belzer, that in the course of trying to prepare the next workforce, to grow this workforce, and to keep them interested in working in the rural parts of the state, that finding clinical sites and finding preceptors and those who are able to give the clinical oversight and experience has become more and more difficult. So this is a problem that was recognized by the group, and this is your proposal to help at least resolve that one particular contributing factor to the workforce shortage. Are there any questions on the do you have another testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have two more, I believe. Dr. Richard Lee, CEO of the Woodland Centers. They provide mental health services in greater Minnesota. And Dr. George Riomoto, he is the professor of psychiatry and the medical director for child and adolescent behavior health services at the University of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. We've come up to the very end of our time here, so we have a few moments. Your testimony is welcome. We need to act on this bill, though, in order to clear the room. So I'm gonna allow you to continue to with your testimony and hope that it helps describe for us what the value of this is so we can act on it today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am a child psychiatrist. That means I had general psychiatry training and then two additional years of child psychiatry training. The important parts to this bill include...
Could you say your name again? We're
George Riomoto, R-E-A-L-M-U-T-O. Professor of psychiatry
I'm a clinician, researcher, and educator, and I want to support this workforce initiative. Just a major part of this bill has to do with mental health. One part of it has to do with training social workers, LMFTs, psychologists. The treatment of mental illness requires a team. We need therapists. Therapists need to work with physicians. If we don't have therapists, then all we have are drugs. That's not the way to be treating people with mental health problems. I need a team around which to work with. I work with children and adolescents. I need that group. This bill has been supported by the three training directors, Mayo, Hennepin County, and University of Minnesota, who are the training directors for general psychiatry. The shortage in psychiatry is significant. The numbers are for child psychiatry are this. 14 child psychiatrists are necessary to treat 100,000 youth. In Minnesota, the rate is 6.7 per 100,000 youth. We are half of what is necessary to treat children and adolescents with mental health problems. It is a similar shortage in general psychiatry. So I hope you will support this. The work that Senator Clausen has done over the past 18 months to identify these shortages is really given us the evidence that we need to move forward. The federal government is not going to support residency training slots. The state needs to step in to increase the number of psychiatrists, mental health workers, so that we can have an adequate workforce. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I'm glad that you came, and thank you for your testimony. This is, I know from the rural part of the state that this access to the child psychiatry, much less general psychiatry, is a crisis. So your message is important to those of us throughout the state, but especially for those of us that are in the rural part of the state, know that this is a really needed area that needs special support. Did you say you had another testifier, Senator Clausen?
I did, Madam Chair, but I believe perhaps he couldn't make it today. He's from outstate Minnesota, greater Minnesota, and apparently couldn't come today.
Okay, thank you. So that gives us some time to take some questions, if there are any, on the proposal. I think it's very clear what the objective is and the foundation that was made in order to come up with these recommendations, but we can certainly... Senator Wicklund.
Oh, Madam Chair, thank you. I just have a brief comment. Being on the commission, I was really impressed with all the testimony we heard about the need for students to have clinical positions to go to, and it seems like we know that we will need more students moving into the workforce in these areas, but if they don't have positions to go to do their clinical training and we don't have preceptors, it's really, really not helpful to encourage more students to go into the preliminary study that they need. So I'm really glad you brought this forward, and I think the council to have the ability to do more planning, I think, would help us out as well. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair, I should add thank you to Senators Wicklund and Senator Benson, who served on the commission. I greatly appreciate their involvement and input. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. I understand the need for this bill, and thank you for your diligence in putting this together. Did I miss the amendment? Have you filled in the amounts yet on the last page, Section 5 of the appropriations for paragraph C and D? I didn't see that on the bill or in the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clausen.
Yeah. We have not completed that page. We will have it done at our next stop on the bill, but we're still gathering some information. Some of that is a projection that we're trying to arrive at, and so right now we're gathering that information so we can make a sound financial commitment there.
Thank you.
This bill has been asked for in state and local government. Would anybody like to make a motion? Sure. Senator Wicklund? Senator Wicklund moves Senate File 1246 as amended be passed and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much. It passes. Thank you so much, and thank you for the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Great. Our committee is at recess. We will reconvene in this room at 5:30.